WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. Sandra Cisneros is a Mexican-American writer who grew up in the barrio of Chicago. The Iowa Writers' Workshop was her ticket out. She writes about what she knows and never read anywhere else, the stories of Mexican-American women, their lovers, their families, their neighborhoods, their work, and their dreams. Each of the stories in her new book, Woman Hollering Creek, is written in a different voice and from a different perspective. She says she felt a responsibility to tell the stories of Latino women who are seldom represented in the mainstream press. Her first book of fiction, The House on Mango Street, was more autobiographical. It's just been reissued by Vintage. Cisneros grew up with a strong father and six brothers, no sisters. She says it was her mother who helped her find her own strength.
I have arrived at my life and my lifestyle mainly through the efforts of my mother, who you see had great aspirations in her life but realized them rather late. And so she was very fierce about making sure that I wasn't going to repeat her life. She was very fierce about making sure that I was going to study and work hard and have a way of supporting myself that was very important to her, that women be able to support themselves. And that's not how my girlfriends were raised, nor my cousins. They were not raised to think that you had to take care of yourself first. My mother assumed that I might marry and probably would, but she said, you never know what's going to happen to your husband. He might die. He might run away. Something could happen. You just have to be able to take care of yourself. So make sure you do that. You can. And so as a consequence, I wasn't very good in the kitchen, and she would, let me study. And I still don't know how to cook very well. And, you know, I would be standing over the rice and letting it burn because I was thinking. I just didn't have the skills it took to be in the kitchen. But that was fine. My mom allowed me to study. And as long as I was studying, it was okay that I wasn't helping her in the kitchen. I could help her later on doing something else.
Would you describe what the neighborhood you grew up in is like?
Well, I grew up in lots of neighborhoods. I like to tell people in the Southwest that I grew up in the border. The border of black and white neighborhoods, because Chicago is very segregated, you see. So there's always that brown corridor between the black community and the white community. And we were a bit amphibious. You know, we kind of didn't get along with either, and we kind of could get along with both. And so I grew up in neighborhoods that were always being rehabbed, people getting shuttled and moved along on the outskirts of where universities were taking over and gentrifying neighborhoods, or neighborhoods that were changing and that we could afford to live in.
You write in, gee, I forget where you said this, that you hate to see the way barrios end up looking like Sesame Street. In the mass media, and I wonder what you were thinking of when you said that.
Well, because, you know, barrios are only cute in the daytime when you go slumming and say, oh, isn't this a great neighborhood? Look, we can go shopping here and have a whole meal for $3.95. But it's not cute if you are stuck there and can't get out and you have to go to work and at 5 o'clock in the morning and walk down to the bus stop at night and hope nobody bothers you, or come home from work evenings and you have to have your husband or your brother or someone pick you up at the bus stop and walk you half a block to your house to make sure that you're not molested. You know, it's not cute if you have no means of leaving. Only, as Eduardo Galeano, a friend of mine, said, only intellectuals think that poverty is attractive. But people who live in those neighborhoods, they don't want to live in those neighborhoods because you don't have city services, you're afraid to go out your door, there isn't enough sky, the schools are the worst schools in the city, and a lot of times your food stores are the worst, everything's the worst.
What was your way of defending yourself when you were a teenager?
I think the way that I defended myself was through books, because I had the ability to transform myself from my environment by reading. I could remove myself from the circumstances by reading and entering other worlds.
But carrying books when you're walking down the street isn't going to exactly warn people away from
I had
from
six brothers.
Okay, well that's a good start.
That was another way, too. But one thing that I always say, you know, I had six brothers, but who protected me from the six brothers?
Did they pick on you a lot? Did they see?
I was, the sister, and so boys have a very different ways of looking at the world than girls do. So, they just kind of harassed me and kidded around, even though they love me very much and take care of me. But they have a very different way of treating me than they do, perhaps, other women.
I want to get back to the idea of if you were brought up differently than your brothers were, do you think that they were given certain freedoms that you weren't allowed? Were your parents very protective of you as the daughter?
Yes, especially my father. But I also have to say that I'm an only daughter, which in a Mexican family elevates me to a status of some type of princess, you see. And it has nothing to do with financial advantages, being the princess. You're the father's favorite child, and Mexican princesses are treated in quite an extraordinary way. They're protected, they're restricted, to go out anywhere. Brother had to escort you at least to the bus stop and bring you back, much to the complaint and lament of the brothers, you see. So it was a little bit difficult. I'm my father's favorite, but because I was the only daughter, the brothers had to do a lot of things for me, and it was it handicapped me in some way, because I was so dependent on having my six brothers rescue me in circumstances. I didn't learn how to drive until very, very late in my life. I was so used to having the brothers rescue me, so to speak.
I think it's fair to say you're a feminist now, yes?
Oh, fiercely.
Yes. So what was the transition between being the protected princess of the family and becoming a feminist?
Well, I think that, for a long time, I didn't question my father's restrictions or my brother's role. I thought that that's how it had to be. And it's very hard for women in my culture, or men, for that matter, to leave their father's home as a single person. You don't leave your parents' home until you're married, yeah. And sometimes not even then. But I found the route out by education. I told my father that I had to go away to school, you see. And by the time I was in graduate school, I was ready to go away. I could have gone away as an undergraduate had my father allowed me to live in the dorms. But my father is a very traditional man, and like many Mexican fathers, wouldn't allow me to live in the dorm, even though I went to school two buses and a couple train rides away in the city of Chicago. But by the time I was ready for graduate school, I'd figured out I'd better pick a school that was in another state, or I'd never get out the door. And I've always used the education and the necessity to write as my key out, you see, even though it is very, very unusual to see a single woman living alone. And it's very unusual to see a woman like myself at 21 years of age living out of state. Also, when I graduated from my MFA, my father still assumed that I would come back home. And to this day, every time I go home, my father says, "Your room is here. When are you going to move back? Why don't you live here and write upstairs?" He still doesn't conceive that at 36 of years of age, I might not move back.
Right. Did you feel socially behind when you went to college, having been protected for
yes,
so long?
Yes, I did. Yes, I did. But see, I only saw myself behind if I looked at myself with my American eyes. If I looked at myself with Mexican eyes, I would see how advanced I was.
Sure.
But it wasn't until I realized the clash of those two values and cultures that I could see myself in a new light. And so in a way, seeing myself through American eyes debilitated me and lessened me, you see.
My guest is Sandra Cisneros. Her new collection of stories is Woman Hollering Creek. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Mexican-American writer Sandra Cisneros is my guest. In your acknowledgments, you thank your mother, who gave you the fierce language.
Yeah, my mother is from a working class neighborhoods in Chicago, and so the English that she learned was what I call the tough, punch you in the nose English, the street English. And I think that voice, that English, and that voice that I hear sometimes in my stories comes from my mom.
It's not a tongue you speak yourself.
I think that I'm a product of my education, and so I'm much more articulate than many people in the neighborhoods my mom was raised in, and I can't help but be a product of my education, but I can give voice to those voices that are, my mother's voice, my community's voices. So I wish I was I had that fierce voice. It comes up in the writing, if not, especially, perhaps not in my own physical voice.
Yeah, because you have a kind of small voice physically.
I have a very thin voice, but it's my disguise, you see.
For
the real me that comes out in these stories.
Is that how you feel?
I certainly feel it. I used to hate this voice because I thought that it pegged me as this passive, quiet little girl. And my size is small, you see. But now I see it as a wonderful shield. And I can get past a lot of guards if I play up that role. People say things in front of me that they wouldn't say in front of other people and ignore that I'm there as an observer and that I'm going to do something.
Is your voice the voice of a princess, you know, the famous princess?
Well, only other princesses recognize that. Like my friend Mary Helen Ponce said, when I knew you, met you, I knew you were a princess. I said, yes, we all recognize each other. So the whole theme of the Mexican princess, which has nothing to do with financial means, is what I'm going to pick up in my novel, the Hijas de Iztaccíhuatl, the daughters of Iztaccíhuatl, you see.
So when you look back on it now, Was it finally an advantage or a disadvantage to be the princess of the family?
I was Cinderella, and that was my nickname as a child. My mother called me that. I was this girl that was living in a poor neighborhood, but I really didn't belong there. I thought very highly of myself, and my father made me believe in that high esteem. So I may have been living in a neighborhood that was run down and in a pumpkin shell, but I believed that it was only temporary, that it was just a spell. You see, and it would break.
Can I ask you to read like a short passage that gives us a sense of the voice that you found in fiction? Do you know what I mean? That other voice?
That the real me?
The fierce language voice.
Oh, well, this is from the silly character in the last story, Bien Pretty. She's part of the Chicana hipwazee, something that I'm part of too. These Chicanas that are so Mexican, they make Mexicans look un-Mexican. We're trying so hard to be Mexican. We're more Mexican than the Mexicans. So I wanted to write about, make fun of that class of educated Chicana women. But it also is a character that I love very much, too. She may be silly, but she also is fierce. Maybe once or maybe never. Maybe each time someone asks, want to dance? At Club Fandango. All for a Saturday night at Hacienda Salas Party House on South Mission Road. Or Lerma's Night Spot on Zarzamora. Making eyes at Ricky's Poco Loco Club or El Taconazo Lounge. Or maybe, like in my case, in my garage making art. Amar es vivir, what it comes down to for that woman at Centeno's and for me. It was enough to keep us tuning in every day at 6:30. Another episode, another thrill. To relive that living when the universe ran through the blood like river water. Alive. Not the week spent writing grant proposals. Not the 40 hours standing behind a cash register, shoving cans of refried beans into plastic sacks. Hell no. This wasn't what we were put on the planet for. Not ever. Not Lola Beltrán sobbing, soy infeliz, into her four cervezas, but Daniela Romo singing, ya no, es verdad que te adoro, pero más me adoro yo. I love you, honey, but I love me more. One way or another, even if it's only the lyrics to a stupid pop hit, we're going to write the world and live. I mean, live our lives the way lives were meant to be lived, with the throat and wrist, with rage and desire and joy and grief and love till it hurts. But goddamn, girl, live.
You know, your whole voice changes when you start speaking in Spanish?
Yeah, it does. Yeah, I think that's a little frightening, too, to think about that. There's something schizophrenic about being Mexican slash Mexican-American, you know, when you are straddling those cultures. And I think that, to me, all the Spanish that I've learned comes from one person in my life. That's my father. And so I really want to explore the relationship of daughters to fathers, the princesses, the relationship of Mexican men and how they love women and how they love daughters. That, to me, is intriguing.
So you think when you speak Spanish, you speak in a more you know, in quotes, male kind of voice because it's your father's voice.
I think so. And it's also a male culture. And also there's a different way of looking at the world. It's a very a tender and affectionate language to me. So it has incredible connotations to it that the English does not.
Sandra Cisneros, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Sandra Cisneros has a new collection of short stories called Woman Hollering Creek. It's published by Random House. Vintage has just brought out a new edition of her first book of fiction, The House on Mango Street. This is Fresh Air.